It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
As well as doing responsible things like exercise and making podcasts, one of the things that's helped me through this period has been beer. And you could get 8 free beers delivered direct to your doorstep. All you need to do is go to beer52.com/party. That's beer, the number 5, the number 2.com/party. And cover just £5.95 for the postage. And you'll get 8 globally sourced fresh craft beers delivered right to your doorstep. You don't even need to leave the house. Think of it as a kind of cabinet of 8 great beers. Each month, Beer 52 send a case of craft beer from a different part of the world. Recent cases have included beer from the Alps, New Zealand, the USA, Ireland, Korea, and Germany. So if you're looking to stock up or just fancy trying something different, Beer 52's Craft Beer Discovery Club is for you. And if you do change your mind, you can pause or cancel your account at any time you like. Every case also includes the award-winning craft beer magazine Ferment and a tasty snack. Just go to beer52.com/party and get your first case of 8 beers for £5.95. That's beer52.com/party. Hello and welcome to The Political Party. This is a treat of an episode to start your weekend with. Chris Bryant, who I wanted to interview about his new book, The Glamour Boys, which is the secret story of the rebels who fought for Britain to defeat Hitler. A fantastic piece of research that he's done and a brilliantly written book about the queer and partly queer MPs who were the first to realise the threat that the Nazis posed and the instrumental role they played in changing Britain's stance on the Nazi Party. So we talk about that, and that in itself is a great story, and the research that he's done is makes for a great listen anyway. But the stuff that has happened to Chris in his life is incredible. He has found himself in some frankly astonishing situations, and he talks about them here openly and candidly. I mean, I there's no exaggeration to say you're not going to be able to believe some of the stuff you're about to hear, because it is incredible. But he just talks about it so well, so honestly and so frankly, that this is just astonishing. So I'm going to shut up and hand over to Chris Bryant, because this is incredible. I began by asking Chris about his new book, The Glamour Boys. Your new book, The Glamour Boys, tells the secret story of the rebels who fought for Britain to defeat Hitler. And there are a few of them, gay or sort of gay members of Parliament.
Queer or nearly queer.
Queer or nearly queer. Queer that's Well,
that's queer, the phrase I use.
Well, it's a phrase you use. Maybe it's a generational thing. For me, the word queer feels... because I remember it being used as an insult, I'm never sure whether it's okay to use it or not.
So it was obviously an insult at the time that I'm writing about, in the 1930s, because it was, I mean, there were so many different offences you could be done for. Gross indecency was the main one, which was a very unspecific crime. I mean, you could even be done for intending to commit gross indecency. So by sending a letter to somebody, assigning it to another man, signing it love Chris or whatever, or love Matt, and lots of other offences as well. And you can be done for next to no, with next to no evidence as well. So in the in England and Wales, the UK, it was very, very frowned upon, and queer would have been a term of abuse then. But I kind of wanted to reclaim it today, because the word gay doesn't work. They would never have known that. And homosexual was kind of around, but just as a medical term rather than anything else. So that's why I've gone for queer or nearly queer, because some of them married, some of them didn't. Who knows whether how much sex they have? I always presume that people have more sex than we know about.
You do say that quite early on in the book, that you presume people were getting more than perhaps they said, which is a kind of a generous assumption to make, perhaps, of some people.
Well, I've tried to look. I mean, because what the key thing about a lot of these men is that they used to go to Germany quite a lot at the beginning of the 1930s, because even though, strictly speaking, it was illegal in Germany under paragraph 175 of the German Penal Code, actually in the Weimar Republic, where the Social Democrats ran the government in Prussia, covering most of Germany, including Berlin, anything went. You could do anything, pretty much. And so there were loads of gay bars. It was the time of, you know, Sally Bowles and cabaret, as it were. And they enjoyed themselves. But back in England, they had to be much more circumspect, though I do point out in the book that there were some kind of underground things you could get up to, not least the Turkish baths in Jermyn Street. The Savoy.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about that in more detail. But I guess from the outset, and you accept this at the start of the book, you're kind of having to fill in the blanks. And one of the things I guess that's quite interesting about even just the discussion we had about the use of the word queer is the language people would have used back then, the way they may well have expressed it, it's kind of written in a code, and you're going back nearly 100 years later and trying to decipher from actually sometimes quite scant historical record what exactly happened. You're not just a biographer, in a way you're a detective.
Yes, and sometimes I've gone back to documents that have been used by other historians, but they kind of left this bit out. So for instance, Harold Nicholson's diaries have been published. They sit in Balliol College Library. There's vast acres of them. And when you go back to the original, you realize that lots of historians have just omitted some of the most interesting things. So his friendship, for instance, with Jack McNamara, who was fair-haired, heavily muscled. We know this because Montgomery commented on it when he went to see his troops in 1940. His relationship with Jack McNamara. We know that they went on various trips together and almost certainly slept together. But likewise, there's this story of Victor Cazalet. So a biography was written of Victor Cazalet in the 70s, I think, and it used one of the three letters that sit in Eton College Library from a guy called Gottfried von Kramm. And the only bit that the biographer then used was the fact that Gottfried was German and he was going to sign up in the German army, not because he supported the Nazis, but because all his brothers were in the army, so he felt he had to as well. But actually, the story is much more interesting because Gottfried von Kramm lost the Wimbledon tennis finals twice, including once to Fred Perry. That's how he got to know Victor Cazalet, because they both played tennis at Wimbledon. Gottfried von Kramm, though married, was arrested for having a sexual relationship with a Jewish man and was sent to a concentration camp in Germany in 1937. And Victor helped get his lover, Manasseh Herbst, out of Germany to Palestine. So suddenly this is a 10 times more interesting story when you tell the whole thing. And how that's all in the letters that were there to find in Eton College archives.
You make the point that some of these men might not have considered themselves gay, they certainly wouldn't have used that word. How difficult is it to tell a story of someone who, you know, were they around today, you might not necessarily get on with or see eye to eye, even on issues about perhaps gay rights?
Look, I'm a Labour MP, and nearly all the people we're talking about here are Conservatives and pretty heavily imperialistic. You know, they were by no means always right. And Victor Cazalet, in fact, visited Dachau and thought it was all rather jolly. It was only later that he felt that he had to, that Britain had to fight Hitler when he saw the Anschluss in Austria. And he was approached by lots of rich people who were Jewish who were begging him to take them back to the UK, even if it meant that they had to work as a gardener. And so it was his passion for the Jewish cause that changed his mind. For Jack McNamara, it was visiting Dachau with Guy Burgess, who was his researcher, later Soviet spy, an Anglican archdeacon and a civil servant from the War Office, both of whom were gay. And they went on some kind of sex trip, as well as visiting Dachau. And I think it was then that changed Jack McNamara's view.
The point of the book is that these queer, partially queer, but I was kind of get nervous about using phrases, but these are...
It's fine.
Queer or partially queer guys were instrumental, actually, in making the case for stopping Hitler. And at the time, people are familiar with the difference between Chamberlain and Churchill, but then perhaps not familiar with the detail of this story, that it was seeing that homophobia and seeing the change from 1930s Berlin and the way the Nazis then started treating gay people with the Night of the Long Knives and then the things that followed, was that actually being queer was crucial for them realising how dangerous Hitler was.
Yes, because they had personal relationships with people who were being arrested, who were in the room when the Night of the Long Knives, Hitler dispatched lots of the gay Nazis. I know it's odd to think of gay Nazis, but quite a lot of the leading Nazis at the beginning in 1930, 1931, 1932 were gay, including Ernst Röhm, who ran the Stormtroopers, and Edmund Hines. And each of these men, as I say, had their own journey. Rob Bernays, very early in 1932, spotted the danger of Hitler and was constantly being accused of being a warmonger for it, was very opposed to Oswald Mosley and the black shirts and the fascists in the UK. Harold Nicholson had friends likewise who shook when he saw them whenever they mentioned going back to Germany. And this group, because they met together so frequently, I mean, they loved going to Bulistan because it was run by a gay guy and his lover. And they loved going to dinner. They loved spending time together. They became the nucleus which associated itself with Anton Eden, in particular when he had to resign as foreign secretary in 1938, and then with Churchill as well. And they met every week. In one or other of their houses, Ronnie Tree, who was bisexual, or Jim Thomas, who was probably gay. And sometimes I think that Eden and Churchill must have been the only completely heterosexual people in the room. And then the extraordinary thing is, because Neville Chamberlain hated them so much, he wanted to denigrate them. He wanted to insinuate something about them. And that's why he called them the Glamour Boys. He'd employed this guy, Sir Joseph Ball, to run a kind of nasty black ops against them. Their phones were tapped. They had nasty articles appearing in the newspapers about why you're still a bachelor and things like that. They were threatened with deselection. The young ones anyway, enlisted in the army, and four of them were killed in action.
And the Glamour Boys, the ones you cover in this book, are the queer or partially queer. But Churchill would have been included in that group of people called the Glamour Boys.
Yes, because it was a way of insinuating something without actually saying it. Because the word glamour then meant something slightly different from today. Today it's entirely positive, but then it meant flighty, bewitching, alluring, and ultimately effeminate. And that's why it was a bit of an attack word to use. But interestingly enough, I think, well, Churchill must have known that Jack McNamara was gay. I mean, I don't think there can have been any doubting it. And yet when Jack was killed in action in 1944, Churchill wrote to Jack's mother, Natalie Orpen, that he was all that a man should be. He was very touched by Ronnie Cartland's death as well. And wrote a very warm eulogy about him. But just to stick with Ronnie Cartland for a moment, who knew that Barbara Cartland had a younger brother? and that Barbara Cartland was this rather wild, entertaining figure, you know, who ran these elaborate, extravagant parties and wrote lots of gossip columns and so on. And I was very, very close to Ronnie, but when he died, she included lots of eulogies that had been written about him, but left one sentence out, which used the word flamboyant, because that was a code word, wasn't it, for gay.
Have you encountered with any of the families of any of the men that you talk about in this book any issue? Has anyone's grandson or great granddaughter said, I'm not comfortable you talking about my granddad or great granddad like this?
I spoke to the Earl of Port Arlington, as you do, who is the son of Viscount Carlo, who was one of Ronnie Cartland's and Ronnie Cartland was his best man. And I said, do you mind if I ask an indelicate question? And he said, you're going to ask me whether my father was homosexual, aren't you? I said, yes. He said, well, I haven't the faintest idea because I was only six when he died. But I can tell you this, his best man, his best friend, the person he always referred to as his number one friend, Ronnie Cartland, he certainly was. So I think there's a changed atmosphere today, isn't there? But Jack McNamara's brother, who was a big figure in the RAF himself in the Second World War, he refused to inherit from his brother because his brother was gay. But his children or grandchildren have been happy to talk to me and are rather proud of their great uncle. And likewise, Herbert Sharp, the Anglican archdeacon married, who was Jack McNamara's partner, lover, sponsor, patron, whatever. His great grandchildren have, they showed me the family photo album with pictures of them both in their swimming trunks by, you know, with some strapping lads in Germany.
It's a fantastic story. And obviously it deals with war. And as you say, some of these men pass away as a result of serving and die in service, serving their country. What made you want to tell it now?
Well, I mean, it's partly just the fluke that I came across this sentence about Jack McNamara when I was writing a history of Parliament, and which said that he'd gone on a sex trips with Guy Burgess and an Anglican archdeacon in Berlin and France, including episodes when they were playing table tennis with a young cyclist naked over the table, acting as the table tennis net. And just somehow that was kind of interesting.
Wow. Very decadent way to play table tennis.
I've never tried it myself. I'm not very good at table tennis. But the key thing for me was, and he, at the time, all the previous historians have said that he was Nazi supporting. And they said that he was a member of the Anglo-German Fellowship. And I've done all the research. There's no... And the Anglo-German Fellowship was undoubtedly a Nazi-supporting organisation. There is no evidence that Jack was a member. There is that Kim Philby and Guy Burgess were, but not of Jack McNamara. So I think people have often misunderstood him, and it's been a delight to be able to sort of bring him back into the light. The other thing is, for me, it's awfully easy. I'm slightly homosexual, as you know. If not completely. And I, it's awfully easy for younger generations of people to think, well, we've won this freedom and it will never be taken away from us again. But you have to remember that 1930s Berlin was the best place in the world to be if you wanted to have a sex life as a gay man. And 6 years later, people were being bumped off, sent to concentration camps. And we don't even know how many gay men were killed by the Nazis. So I don't want us to be complacent. And then the final thing that I think is really important for today is these were rebels. They were threatened with deselection. Ring any bells in recent conflicts? I mean, both major political parties, you know, trying to purge people that didn't quite fit with the leadership. And I just think that one of the good things about our political system when it works well is that rebels... can be valued like precious diamonds.
And as a group, were they close as a group? Were they all friends? Or were there, you know, with any extended group, sometimes you get a core group, there are people that kind of come in and out on the periphery. How did they interact with each other?
They used to have meetings in one or other of their houses near Westminster every week. They used to go to dinner at one or other of their clubs together, the Travellers or the Beefsteak or sometimes the Carlton, though. Once Jack McNamara had made a speech about Jew baiting, attacking Jew baiting in England. It's an odd phrase, but that's a phrase he used at the time. He went to the Carlton that evening and was spat at and never went back to the Carlton again. He was called a Jew lover boy, which was obviously a double attack on sexuality and Judaism. And but so they used to meet together and dine together regularly. In particular, Jack McNamara, Rob Bernays, Ronnie Cartland, Harold Nicholson, Ronnie Tree, that group all the time. And but also interestingly, when Anthony Eden resigned. Anthony Eden, incidentally, always called men dear. Just saying. But when he resigned, everybody he turned to in the next 48, 72 hours for advice on what speech to make, how to get support in the chamber, all of those, they were all gay. All of them. It was just really, really striking.
And what do you deduce from that?
That he was very relaxed about it. That it was a community of people that he felt very happy with. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind, of course, that you could live your whole life entirely with men if you wanted to. If you were in the army, you weren't able to marry in the army unless you got permission from your commanding officer. So lots of, you know, army barracks were entirely homosocial affairs. The parliament, Churchill described as a masculine assembly with some pride. Your club, most of your social life, you could lead it entirely with men. Plus then, of course, the splendid additional women who invited you to dinner as socialites, like Emerald Cunard and Nancy Astor and so on.
For you then, how, I guess you identify with them to some extent, but do you, with the freedoms that we now enjoy in 2020, although of course I say that as a straight man, and I realise that I don't suffer the homophobia that you will have suffered, when you're researching people that have gone before you, trailblazers in so many ways, and you read about the things that were said at the time and the way people were talked about at the time, does that still wound you in the present when you're researching, effectively, in a way, the history of prejudice?
Well, I'm conscious that everybody has a path through life. And with all of these characters, I've tried not to paint them as better than they are. You know, they are warts and all. And Rob Bonet's, on a couple of occasions, lied to protect himself and because he didn't want to lose his job in government. And if you look at Harry Cruikshank's diaries up against Rob Bonet's diaries, that, you know, that is just the case. But, and I've spoken to Rob Bonet's both his sons, and they let me see all his papers and stuff, which is a delight. So I've always believed that people aren't one thing or another. They're streaky.
Like Bacon.
Yes, exactly. Or feet of clay, however you want to put it. But and streaky bacon is better than the other kinds of bacon because it's got more taste. I hope there's a sense of suspense in the book because you don't know which way each of them is going to go. It takes Victor Kazala a long time to come on board. And sometimes they're getting into trouble as well. And I've tried to give that sense of fun as well. Victor Cazalet ran in the war. He set up an anti-aircraft battery in Sevenoaks, which he ran. And Victor was a director of the Dorchester. So he used to interview any prospective members of the battery at the Dorchester for dinner. And his regiment was known as either the Monstrous, or his battery rather, was known as the Monstrous Regiment of Gentlemen, because it had so many gay men and artists and writers and so on in it, or as the Buggers Battalion. And I came across one great story of a chap advising his daughter's about to be husband not to join the Buggers Battalion, but asking his wife to leave the room before he told her.
You're as well as being an author, obviously, a member of Parliament, and before that, a Church of England vicar. How strange is it to be a gay man drawn to what are quite conservative, small-c conservative, institutions?
Incidentally, just before I answer that, one of the nice things about Ronnie Carlin for me and Jack McNamara was that the first thing they rebelled on was financial assistance to the depressed areas, including the Rhondda.
Also, there's a local element as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a minor part of the story, but it was nice to me. And I think by the end, Ronnie Cartland was so fed up with the Conservative Party that he wanted to join the National Labour Party. Whether he'd have joined the Labour Party or not, I don't know in the end, but he anyway. So, I mean, there are bits of me that are quite conservative. I like tradition, but I also want to break it. I want to make it work for today and so on. So I like icons, but I like breaking them.
That's a healthy attitude, particularly for...
But it's worth it. But I like the way you're basically pointing out that I am now careering from career to career.
I wasn't going to quite put it like that.
It's the words of Stephen Sondheim.
Well, I'm happy to identify myself with someone who can express my questions better than I can. But I guess what I meant was you've had two, and being an author obviously is an extra career while you're still a politician. But I think for any politician to have been a politician and been part of a church or organised religion is quite an interesting thing, that perhaps this part of you that's drawn to institutions where you can have influence and look after people.
I've worked for the BBC as well. I've been in nearly every.
Does that fit that description of the BBC?
I was going to say I've been in nearly every institution apart from a psychiatric ward and a prison so far. The truth is that what happened when I was young, my mum was alcoholic and it killed her. And when I arrived at university, I felt that I had managed to survive relatively well, not because I was a particularly great person, but because I must have some kind of inner strength and because I'd had great people surrounding me and caring for me and supporting me, including a wonderful man called Sam Salter, whose daughter, Rebecca, is now the president of the Royal Academy and a great friend. And I think that that's when I knew that my life, whatever I ended up doing for a job, my life couldn't just be about me. This is sounding terribly pious now. I don't mean it that way, but it had to be about doing something for others as well. And there is an element of being MP for the Rhondda, which is very similar to being a vicar in High Wycombe or wherever else, because you are, you know, your primary focus is the community that you try to serve.
People often think of the church as being quite a homophobic place. I grew up going to church regularly, and it was a Church of England parish that I was an altar boy in. I never, although again, I'm not gay, so I might not have heard it or encountered it or spotted it in the same way, and I was young. But it never really struck me that most people who go to church were homophobic. And it actually wasn't something that was ever really discussed that much. Was it something you encountered much as a vicar?
I can't remember how old you are. I'm 58.
I'm 38.
So I think when I was born, homosexuality was still a criminal offence. And I knew people, Ilted Harrington, for instance, who was a big figure in the London Labour Party, who remembered days when if they were burgled, they couldn't report it to the police because the police would arrest them for sleeping in the same bed rather than arrest anybody for burgling them. And when I arrived on the church scene, I hadn't quite sorted out what my sexuality was. My girlfriend was quite insistent that I was gay. She sang at my wedding in the end.
Wow.
in the Palace of Westminster many years ago, well, 10 years ago. And the second thing was that the church previously, its line had been don't ask, don't tell. And there were lots of, I mean, nearly every inner city parish, because there were no women priests at the time, every inner city parish priest was a gay man. I remember one bishop saying to me, I'm really sorry, Chris. I decided I had to appoint a straight priest in one of the deaneries because otherwise there wouldn't be a single straight priest in the whole 20 parish area. But then came Mrs. Thatcher with Michael Howard's local government bill and clause 28.
Section 28, yeah.
Section 28, which, you know, prohibited teaching of homosexuality in schools, and the church decided that it ought to know about you, and then thought, well, actually, that doesn't really fit with church's teaching. I remember Richard Harries, who was the bishop who ordained me, giving a silly newspaper interview about 6 months after he'd ordained me, saying he'd never laid hands on a gay man, which A, was quite funny in itself, but B, I thought, well, what do you think I am, Richard? I was the first person you ordained. And oddly, I mean, now we're great friends, and he came to our wedding. Everybody came to our wedding.
I was going to say, this remarkable wedding of yours where all these...
Cilla Black came. Surprise, surprise.
But your amazing girlfriend, who you then keep in touch with and ends up singing at your wedding, sounds like a remarkable person.
She's wonderful. Donna Sotomoratini. She's American, she's a singer. She teaches musical theatre. We were in Threepenny Opera together. I played Mac the Knife. Badly.
Well, they say politics is showbiz for ugly people, but you are you're not an ugly person. That wouldn't be fair. But do you think that's...
Boy, calm down now. Easy, Tiger.
But do you think that some politicians have that frustrated performer? Do you identify that in yourself?
Well, I also wrote a biography of Glenda Jackson, and Glenda always used to say that the difference between Parliament and theatre was that Parliament is under-rehearsed and badly lit. She's right about badly lit. The chamber is really badly lit. And in fact, for people with disabilities, it's one of the most common complaints. I've always thought that politics is about three things. It's about what you believe. It's about how you would want to implement what you believe. So your policies and things like that. And it's about how you perform. And being able to perform is the key part of it, because all we have is words and your own personality, I suppose.
But is there a parallel universe where Chris Bryant goes off to play Broadway and never enters politics?
Yeah, I play it out in my head every night. The thing is, I'm not sure my... I used to sing a lot. I was in the National Youth Theatre, and I did act a lot. I mean, I've been on holiday with Daniel Craig. I'm not sure I was a very good actor. I was offered a part in... what's it called? The film with Rupert Everett and Colin Firth, Another Country.
And why didn't you take it?
Because I was about to start at theological college, and it involved snogging another man in a boat.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, as I say, the Church of England wasn't entirely...
All right, okay, fair. Yes, of course, yeah. God, I'm stupid. Your civil partnership, the first civil partnership conducted at Parliament.
Yes, this was a strange moment in a way, because... So the law at the time said that MPs and the children of MPs can get married in the crypt chapel. But that's not available to homosexuals, because that's Church of England rules, and the Church of England doesn't marry gay couples. So that left us with the problem. Because we wanted to do it in Parliament, because we weren't allowed to, we definitely wanted to.
Yeah.
So there were two options, and Gordon got in touch, Gordon Brown, the night before a liaison committee, because he wanted to announce something the next day. And he decided that what he wanted to announce was that he was going to make it possible for me and Jared to get married in Parliament by basically having either changing the law or licensing Parliament. And in fact, that's what we went for in the end, with Burko was very helpful in that. And it meant that anybody can now get married in Parliament. Since we started it, because it's licensed and they do 20 or 30 a year.
So did you lobby Gordon Brown for that then, or did this just come out of nowhere?
Well, oddly enough, Sarah Brown and Cilla Black had come to a dinner. I was a Foreign Office minister at the time, had come to a dinner at the Foreign Office for the Terence Higgins Trust, their supper club thing. And we and Jared and I discussed it with Sarah then, and I think she must have said something to Gordon, and he was searching for something to announce. There was a very weird thing about it, though. Chris Mullin was, I was quite friendly with Chris Mullin, he seemed very in favour, and you'd think he would be liberal on these kind of things. But in his diaries, he refers to being rung by Burko, asking him what did he think about being allowed to have civil partnerships in Parliament because Chris Bryant wanted to do one. And he said that he says in his diary that he told Burko it's a step too far at this stage.
Wow.
I know.
Have you spoken to him about it?
Yes.
And what does he say?
He says, I have no idea what I was thinking. I have no idea what I was thinking.
My God, but he's then obviously printed these diaries and let it be in there. He's not taken that bit out.
I know. Weird, isn't it? So I keep a diary, and I'm now terrified of what's in my diary, that I'm going to incriminate myself.
But that's what makes those Ben, Clark, Mullin, you know, the Campbell, that's what makes a good political diarist. Edwina Curry is leaving it all in and it being in chronological order. That's what makes them different to retrospective biographies where you can polish this stuff out. That's what makes them such important. Oh, wow, look at that. So that's from, and so
that's 2002 to 2003.
And you're right. So these are all written out in longhand. Special pen or just any old biro?
Any old pen, just so that I can I can't correct it.
And you've been keeping them what since you got elected?
I think that's the first one. That's 2000. I started the 20. So I was elected 2001, but I started on the 24th of April, 2002. Yeah, volume one.
And how often do you keep it?
I feel a bit depressed tonight.
Does that narrow it down, or could that be the start of any? That could be the start of any end.
I write probably 5 times a week.
Okay.
So it's not every day, and I do it in the morning about the day before, rather than at the end of the day.
And is that why is that?
Well, I don't know. It's just because it's when I feel like writing, and sometimes I'll do it on the train, or I'll do it in the library, or whatever. So it's not. It's when I feel like it rather than... I didn't want to be a slave to it. I wanted to do it because I wanted to do it.
I wondered if you didn't want to do it on the night of the day so that you just had at least a bit of thinking time rather than just... Maybe they'd be angrier if they were written at night.
Well, they might be more drunken.
Well, that's a good point, actually. You need to be able to read what you've written. Maybe it was because of that.
My handwriting, well, I can read my handwriting, but I'm not sure many others can. But it was when the whole Leveson thing happened, it was quite useful because I could go back and find things by date and work out what order things happened in and so on.
And let's talk about Leveson, but just before that, did you keep these with the intention of one day publishing them, or what was the intention of starting a diary?
So I think round about volume four, I decided that I would probably end up publishing. And interestingly, as a historian now, it's been so invaluable going back to the original of Harold Nicholson's diaries in Balliol College, Oxford. And for that matter, the handwritten diary that Rob Bernays kept from 1930 in Australia, which fills in a whole story which nobody has ever been able to look at before. I'm conscious that, well, what are the paper documents from this era? I don't think there are many diarists at the moment. I probably will publish, but it'll have to be heavily cut because there must be about 5 bazillion words in there already.
But what an amazing period.
And I feel depressed tonight. 2015, 2017, 2019.
And why did you feel depressed that night if it's not too bleak to dip back into that very first entry? That would have been a year in, so maybe...
I think from memory, it's the day that... I know exactly what happened. I'd gone for dinner with a friend.
Yeah.
who was in a very weird state at the time, and he was drunk before he arrived, and we then had quite a bit. And this was the first, it's the first time I spoke to Tony Blair after getting elected, and he was in the lobby voting with me, and I was not very sober, I don't think. Oh, and I must have breathed all over him. So that's why.
And did he notice? Did he say, "Oh, Chris, you look like you've had a few"? Looks like it's
lied. I can't remember. There's lots of Tony stories. There's lots of Tony stories.
Well, it's a remarkable era.
But also, I during the whole Brexit saga last year, I chaired all the meetings of the kind of rebels, the Dominic Grieve, you know, the rebels on both sides. And obviously I've kept a record of all of that.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You mentioned Leveson. I mean, you had an incredible experience with it. You were instrumental in having the inquiry set up in the first place. But what's it like to have your phone hacked? You know, I read accounts of Paul Gascoigne and the fact that he thought his family was spying on him and it ruined personal relationships. Did you go through a similar thing?
Yes, a bit. I mean, I was obviously only of interest to them for a very short period, unlike much more famous people. But the weirdest thing, I mean, and when it all happened, that there was way back in 2003, there was all sorts of attempts to blackmail me and all sorts of things going on. And I'd had to call the police, and it was all very unpleasant. But then I'd kind of got over that and then it was in 2009 that I spotted that, you know, the police were admitting that there were lots of papers that they had never done anything about from Glenn Mulcair. And so I wrote to them and said, can you just see if there's anything that relates to me? And they replied to say, we can't tell you. And then I was up. So then I got a lawyer to write to them, and they said, well, actually there is some paper. And I said, well, what do you mean some paper? Is it like a book? Is it a post-it note? Yeah. You know, what is it? And they wouldn't tell me because they said it would infringe the privacy of other people on the piece of paper. Anyway, eventually we had to sue the Metropolitan Police to get it, which cost £400,000 legal fees, which in the end the Met had to pay, which is just ludicrous of the Met, a complete waste of their money. And that's why everybody else got to see all the information, because we sued. But the two pages relating to me just had a series. So there's my name and number at the top, and my address, and some names of other people in my family and things like that, and their telephone numbers. I don't know how they got hold of them. And then a series of kind of notes about that. I had a car on hire purchase, and so the number relating to that. They'd obviously rung, I don't know how they, and a whole series of telephone numbers of other people who had rung and left messages for me.
And the blackmail, how does that happen? Does that sort of come out of the blue and someone just posts a letter through your front door?
Exactly so.
And it was...
Which oddly...
From who?
When it came, I rang the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, who sent the head of crime, and who came to the office, and I gave it to him, and he said, "Oh well, this is up very clearly, obviously a crime." Blah blah blah. I never heard another word from him. This was, and I only know because in my diary I looked up later who it was, and it was Inspector Yates of the Yard, the man who was, you know, right in the thick of it with being employed by News International and all the rest of it.
I've never been blackmailed. I never am, but I imagine it to come with those cut-out letters from a newspaper, and I don't know what
it wasn't. It wasn't that, but it was anyway. Yeah.
And that must be a horrible thing to receive.
Well, that whole period, I don't think I slept for 4 months. And I remember when the woman from the Mail on Sunday turned up on my doorstep. She was wearing, in the Rhondda, she was wearing a very, very smart coat. And I thought, you're not from round here. And sure enough, she wasn't. But bizarrely, I then had to go on the train from the Rhondda to Southampton, which is a bugger of a journey.
Yeah.
And there was no seat for the whole of the journey. And obviously I couldn't ring anybody to talk to anybody, or lawyers or anything like that. It was... And then I had to speak to the Southampton Fabians and then get on the train back.
I mean, the hell that they put people through. You're able to smile about it now and hopefully you've dealt with it all. But really, it's a form of psychological torture, what you were subjected to.
It's the only time in my life I've ever contemplated suicide. It was terrible. Most MPs were fine. Only one was not. Who is now a very senior figure in Parliament.
What wasn't fine with you?
It was terrible to me.
What, as a result of the phone hacking?
Mm-hmm.
Because they were on Murdoch's side?
Because basically. Yeah. I mean, you've got to remember that all of this happened because earlier on in the year in 2003, I had asked Rebecca Brooks, have you ever paid a police officer for information? And she said yes, sitting next to Andy Coulson, who then went on to become David Cameron's. And funnily enough, years later, going back to the Chris Mullin story.
Yeah.
So Chris Mullin and I were both close friends with a guy called Tom Fletcher, who used to work at Downing Street as Foreign Office kind of political advisor in Downing Street to Tony, then Gordon, and then David Cameron. And he's now master at Hertford College, Oxford. And Chris Mullin and I both turned up at the same time for the farewell party at Downing Street under David Cameron. And when you arrive in Downing Street, you have to leave your mobile phone in a kind of box thing in the hall. So, which I'd done. And as we were coming up the stairs, I could see Andy Coulson standing there. And his face was saying, what the hell are you doing in here? And I just said, it's all right, Andy, if you want my mobile phone, it's down by the front door.
Oh my, how did he take that?
He laughed, you know.
But what, oh my word, just the interpersonal drama of that, that you can face. I mean, I thought people will reflect their own about what it said about Cameron's judgment employing him in the first place. But having to come face to face with him in the heart of government to deal with people that have their actions and their decisions led to awful. The fact that you were contemplating suicide and then a couple of months or a few years later, there you are face to face with him. It's almost, you can't imagine how that feels for you.
Their argument is that they're just doing their job kind of thing, and it's not for them to worry about what people feel at the other end of the scale.
Yeah, and I'm sure they would.
Anyway, it feels like a very long time ago. And the weird thing is that because all of that happened back then, there was nothing Murdoch could do to me. You know, to some degree, what doesn't kill you does make you stronger.
I just can't get over that senior parliamentarian. I can understand people approving or disapproving of any question at a select committee, however it might appear to the rest of us that it is a legitimate question. But it sounds like they went further than that and went out of their way to be quite unpleasant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, definitely. Yeah.
And what?
But you've got to bear in mind that how frightened people were of the Murdoch Empire. You know, I mean, there were people who were given nice columns in newspapers to keep them quiet. And then there were people who were just terrified of what would be written about them. And I mean, I even remember Tom Baldwin, who incidentally is married to a Nicholson of Harold Nicholson's fame. Everything goes around in circles, doesn't it? But Tom telling me that I was not to speak in the debate on phone hacking because it would imperil Ed Miliband's chances of, you know, winning a general election. And I said, well, it's a bit late now, mate, because it's the motion's down in my name.
I'm sure listeners know who Tom Baldwin is, but at the time he was head of comms for Fred Miliband and went on to work for People's Vote and various things. And what
Tom and I laugh about it now.
Okay, well, that's good. It's nice for the people can all make friends in the end. It's reassuring, I think, for readers and listeners.
Well, and to be fair to Ed Miliband, I think it was kind of a moment that helped define him.
Well, it's that and energy prices are the kind of two things, well, and changing the leadership rules of the Labour Party. But the things that he would say in his plus column would be standing up to Murdoch and perhaps the energy firms as well. I mean, obviously, you can't tell us who this senior parliamentarian, unless you would like to tell us who this beastly individual was. But what do you think what explains their motivation in being so unpleasant to you then? Was it the column or was it the...
Oh, he's homophobic.
Right.
Straight homophobia. Told me I should be ashamed of myself and shouldn't be an MP because I was gay.
And this obviously wasn't that long ago. This is just incredible.
Well, that happened quite a long time ago, 15 years ago, but that person is still a senior figure in Parliament today.
On the government side?
I'm not going any further.
I guess this will all be in the diaries. I mean, would you leave stuff like that in the diaries or would you take stuff like that out?
Well, my husband says he's going to edit it so that it's tidied up. But I don't know whether that might just make it rather dull. Just an endless series of, I feel a bit depressed tonight.
And then just redacted. I suppose what you could do is bring out the sanitised version and then have a kind of director's cut where it's all the...
I think that might be troubling the British public too much.
Well, I'd buy both editions if nothing else. So two sales guaranteed there. Before you became an MP then, you did stand in 1997. You stood in Wickham and were unsuccessful, which is possibly a foregone conclusion. But in 1997, it felt like Labour could win anywhere. So at any point during that campaign, did you think, actually, I might end up being the MP for Wickham here?
Well, funnily enough, you may recall in the 1997 you're not really old enough, are you? But in the 1997 general election, the Guardian rang me about 10 days before the election itself to say they were going to do polling in, I think it was 90 constituencies in the UK, where they thought Labour might take the seat off the Tories. And they were choosing between Stephen Twigg and me.
Oh, boy.
And they did Stephen Twigg. I said that we won't win here. You know, do Stephen Twigg. And I think that's one of the things that contributed to consolidating all the Liberal votes behind Labour and defeating Michael Portillo.
It was Bryant Watt won it for Stephen Twigg.
But ironically then, of course, but if I'd won then, it would have been difficult for me still to be an MP for Wickham, yes. I think, now. And Stephen's been in and out and in again and out.
Yes.
And I'm still here, again, going back to Stephen sometime.
So in the end...
And incidentally, it was Wickham because it was where I'd been the curate in the parish church. And we went from third to second. And then there was a recount and everybody thought it was because I had just lost or was had won or whatever. And it wasn't. It was because the Greens had lost their deposit.
I interviewed Geisler Stewart a few weeks ago, and her account of how she got selected for that seat for Birmingham Edgbaston is fascinating. How do you, how did you win the Rhondda selection? Because you're not from there. You're coming from outside. In 2001, any safe seat would have been hotly contested. How did you win them over?
So I was born in Cardiff and brought up to the age of seven living in Penarth. And Alan Michael was intending to stand down because he was going to be in the Assembly. And so I'd been sort of pursuing the parliamentary seat of Cardiff South and Penarth and was doing all right. And then suddenly the Welsh, the Assembly Labour group got rid of Alan Michael as its leader. And he decided that he was going to stick with Westminster. Thank you very much. So I then rang the General Secretary of the Welsh Labour Party, Jessica Morden, now MP in Newport, and said, well, that's it, ta-ra, I'm off, you know, I've tried my best. And she said, no, put your name in for the Rhondda. I said, I can't. I mean, I don't know anybody in the Rhondda. And she said, yes, you do, you know Anita. I said, all right, yeah, I know Anita, but she won't vote for me because I'm not a woman. So, you know, I mean, I don't see how that helps at all. She said, put your name in. But it started 3 weeks ago. Put your name in. I put my name in. 52 people applied. We got to the shortlisting meeting and somebody had been ringing round saying, you know, he's gay. And, well, it was the best thing ever for me, to be honest, because when you're knocking on people's doors and saying, hello, my name's Chris Bryant, you don't immediately want to start talking about your sexual preferences. But you sort of don't want to have deceived anybody. So it meant that at the shortlisting meeting, I could go, look, I know some of you had telephone calls about me. I think you know why you've had them. It's perfectly true. I am a gay man, but I don't want to be the gay candidate. I want to be the Labour candidate. I was taught that you judge somebody according to, not according to the colour of their skin, their what accent they speak with, what school they went with, whether they're male or female or anything like that. You simply judge them according to the strength of their character and whether they do what they say they will. And I hope that you will judge me on that same basis here tonight. And I thought, well, I've done my I am what I am moment. And they'll all applaud, and they all applauded and it had standing ovation, all of that lot. And I thought, but they'll still keep me off the shortlist because they say that's just too difficult. But in the end, I won the nomination.
And the person making the calls, was that from a particular opponent?
Yeah.
And did you know who it was?
Yes.
And are they a politician now?
Yes.
A member of Parliament?
Not a senior politician. No. God. I mean, and we're fine with each other now. But
you're anyway. A remarkably forgiving man.
Well, I can't see the point in holding up, you know, using energy to hold on to bad stuff, really. Interestingly enough, Chris Evans, also Labour MP in South Wales, he was in the room when I was selected. And I think, so far as I know, he's the only person who has ever admitted to having voted for me to be the candidate.
I'm sure there are others. There must be others in that local group who remember it.
No. They all said, oh, no, I voted for somebody else. It was very controversial at the time. The Independent's headline was, how pink was my valley? And the Telegraph predicted that I would lose because I was gay.
It is incredible.
And I won by 10,000.
I mean, even now, we still have a long way to go. But particularly in Labour circles, I think sometimes people can feel that, oh, we've always been very open and woke and politically correct for a long time. The Labour Party may be left-wing in some ways, and as we've discovered over the last few years, actually can be very regressive in others. And in things like homophobia, lots of people join the Labour Party because they believe in protections for workers. They don't necessarily believe in anything more progressive beyond that. It's remarkable that even in the noughties, you were experiencing homophobia within the Labour movement.
Oh, I was told by a Tory MP in the chamber who's now in the House of Lords, Andrew Robertson, with whom I'm also friendly. He said he would not give way to me because I was a notorious homosexual who would never have children of my own. And this was a debate on smacking.
What year was that? This must have been after 2001 then.
Yeah, this is 2000 and, I don't know, 7, 8, something like that.
I mean, it's basically last week.
It's not, but you know, it's around. But honestly, I think there was a prejudice about working class communities as well amongst the media, who thought that somehow or other the Rhondda would be, you know, very unforgiving. I'm president of several rugby clubs in my patch. I go and speak at the dinner, and you know, all the members of the Gallon Club, once they've drunk their gallon, start taking the mickey. And it's absolutely fine. And I give as good as I get.
I don't doubt that, but that's amongst friends, isn't it? That's different.
Yes, but my point is that I think it's a people in the Rhondda, everybody lives on top of each other all the time. And they've got bigger things to worry about, has been my experience. And an interesting story from the book, actually, relates to the Rhondda, because in 1925, a young lad called Thomas, who was a railway porter in Tonopandy, was arrested in London outside, I think, the Drury Lane Theatre, and he was given 6 months in prison. The only evidence of his gross indecency was that he was carrying a woman's powder puff in his pocket. And what really charmed me was two things about this story. Obviously, it's terrible that he went to prison for nothing. But two things, nice things. First of all, that he asked the local MP in the Rhondda, Labour MP, to stand character witness for him. And he did, even though he was a deacon in the Baptist church, which I think is lovely. And secondly, about 6 months after he's come out of prison, his mother tells a journalist, oh, yes, he's been given his job back at work and everybody's very happy with him and nobody seems to mind at all. So, you know, the Rhondda isn't as people have often portrayed it.
That's very true. Just to come back to Leveson, I wanted to ask you about something else I've just remembered. It led to, and in the age of YouTube, you can watch these things forever, a fantastic moment between you and Kay Burley, where she talks about, and I'm going purely off memory, because I haven't watched it for ages, but it's about how you hack her phone or something like that. And you and her, well, she's actually quite rude to you at one point, and then you firmly say, what's it? Don't speak about what you don't know, madam. It's just at that point you go, right, this interview has changed. Is she someone you have forgiven and spoken to? Because I've seen you.
We're best mates now. It's more a question of has she forgiven me. But the thing was, it was weird because at the time, Sky studio wasn't working here. So you were down the line, basically talking into a camera with no idea of who was at the other end. Yes. I had no idea it was Kay Burley or who Kay Burley was. I was just talking to to a person. And there were two bits to it. There was one bit where she said, well, basically all you had to do was change your PIN number.
That was it. That was it.
And I launched at that and said, no, you are absolutely wrong. You simply do. If you had followed any of the way, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the second bit was, which was much naughtier of me, really, was that she said, so what are you going to say that now? I'd said
oh,
that, you
know,
it was endemic, and she said, are you saying that on television now? I said, well, I've already said it twice. If you don't mind me saying so, you seem a little dim.
It was fantastic television.
It was very naughty, really. But anyway, I mean, I've also recently had a big old rap with Dan Wooden.
I was coming to that, where slightly more justified, and not that you were unjustified in rebutting the way Kay Burley had handled that particular story. With Dan Wooden recently, I mean, it's sort of new growth of this type of radio presenter where the videos are clipped and put online. It feels quite an American model they're trying to do over here in the UK, where it's deliberate baiting of people and it doesn't seem to add any value to the debate, but he got more than he bargained for when he had a conversation with you.
Again, I had no idea who he was. I'd never heard of Dan Wotton. I was just doing an interview. I thought about the firebreak starting in Wales on Talk Radio. And I suppose I sort of knew that Talk Radio is also Murdoch. I hadn't realised that Dan Wotton had written articles supporting the Great Barrington, the Great Barrington Declaration, you know, and COVID denying and all that kind of stuff in The Sun. And that he's normally a kind of celebrity journalist.
Yes, that's what I'd sort of first been aware of him as. Was
yeah. Well, I'd never heard of him at all. And so he started off quite aggressively. And I was sitting in the smoking room in the House of Commons, which, as you know, you can't smoke in, but it's and it's empty. And you can't drink in either, because there's no drink in Parliament. So it's all completely empty. It was just me in there on my mobile phone doing this, not really focusing very much. And he was quite aggressive. And I said, oh, well, you've obviously got an idea, a view. Why don't you just tell us what it is? And then it went downhill from there, basically. And then I sort of went, oh, I've just realised you're a nutcase. And I shouldn't have used the word nutcase. And then he went on and on and on. And I went, oh, I've realised you're a dangerous nutcase. It's worse. And he then started, you know, sort of say, well, I think I'm going to throw you off. And by that time, I'd already switched him off. He then wrote an article, a whole column about how terrible I was. And he's had several programmes devoted to, you know, slagging me off. And there we are.
But that's what they want. They do that on purpose. They want to have an argument with someone. Yeah, that's the whole point. It's not even about whether they are seen to win or lose the argument. There's a shamelessness to it. So even though you watch that conversation between you and him, you are clearly, if there is to be a victor, it's clearly you. You know, you express yourself and conduct yourself in it. In a far more articulate and thoughtful way. You can kind of see what he's up to. He won't mind that. He will love the fact that it gets shared. He won't go, oh no, that clip of me is being shared online. He'll probably think,
oh no, no, of course not. No, no. Indeed, though, of course, I mean, as I understand it, he had quite a lot of homophobic abuse after. He's gay as well, isn't he? He had a lot of homophobic abuse after that. Which is horrible as well. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure that all of that works very well in this world of social media, really.
And it does feel, and I don't consider myself to be any sort of, you know, it sounds like quite an establishment thing to say. That whole thing just doesn't kind of work here. It doesn't feel like it fits the British media. It feels like an American or Australian thing. Now maybe they end up creating a market for it. I don't know, but it does feel, it feels kind of surreal watching it tried in the
UK. It's a big difference between LBC and Talk Radio, isn't it? Because LBC is their phrase, you know, leading Britain's conversation. I think it is easier to listen to because it is more of a conversation, whereas Talk Radio just seems to be all about, you know, howling at the moon.
It's interesting talking to you about this, obviously, because you've, with Leveson and everything, you're someone who's considered and thought about the role of the media and how it should be regulated and how it affects our lives, and also the extent that media organisations are prepared to go to, some of them perhaps, to silence other people. Looking at the media landscape as it is now, post-Leveson, and obviously Leveson 2 never happened, but just in terms of the media, do you feel as if, though, the lessons have effectively been learned and that things have changed, or that there was a brief period where the public thought about it and actually that stuff's probably still going on?
Well, I mean, I've met the McCanns, I've met the Christopher Jeffries.
Dowlers?
Yes. All of those people, and Charlotte Church for that matter, and it's all pretty upsetting, and I'm sure all of that stuff still happens. They're probably just a bit more careful about it legally. And interestingly, of course, everybody always thought it was just one rotten, their argument was it was one rotten apple. And then it turned out it was a whole barrel of apples, and it wasn't just one person and all the rest of it. And my guess is that some newspapers got off pretty lightly. Anyway, I mean, we, you know, suing, I only really sued the to try and get to the truth, really. But we got 30 grand and everybody told me, well, you know, you should give that to charity. And I'm afraid I said, bugger that for a game of soldiers. So we got a new bathroom.
The Murdoch suite.
That's exactly what we call it. And every time I use it, I think of him.
Oh, boy.
I don't mean when I'm having a shower.
No, I kind of,
I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair.
I can't remember who I was talking to this. It was another guest I was talking to recently. Just about that, there was a period where select committees were where it was at. You know, you think of Bob Diamond, obviously the Murdoch one himself, and the Coulson Brooks one. I mean, when you're on a committee facing up to people like Coulson and Brooks, the adrenaline must be like nothing else. And it's a different type of scrutiny to the House of Commons chamber. You've got more time. They can't bluff in the same way that a minister can at the dispatch box. It's more intense. It's more forensic. Using those questions that you get and for maximum advantage in an arena like that, did you put a lot of pressure on yourself going into that exchange about what you were going to ask and how focused you were going to be?
Gosh, I can't remember. I think I knew I wanted to ask that question, and it was the last question of the session because Gerald cut me off afterwards, Gerald Kaufman, and I never quite understood why. That we had, I got on very well with Gerald, and we, the committee went, Gerald used to like taking the committee to the States every year.
Great.
Preferably to Hollywood. And I only went the once, but we went to Fox Studios and had lunch with Rupert. And because Gerald and Rupert were in the Oxford Labour Club together when Rupert got thrown out for rigging the vote. So there was this strange moment when we are approaching each other down a very long path on a very hot day. Gerald and his team from the committee and Rupert and his team, it's all very Reservoir Dogs kind of thing. And then we had lunch and Murdoch he wears a lot of rings and he kept on going at this all the time, sort of disconcerting all his team who looked terrified. And I was sitting next to him. Anyway, afterwards, I told a story to the newspapers about all of this. And I said that we'd had lunch in the Judy Garland room. And Gerald came up to me that evening, furious after the vote. And he said, Christopher, you know perfectly well that we do not refer to events that have happened on tour anywhere, and certainly not to the press. And even more importantly, it's the Shirley Temple room, not the Judy Garland room.
So was the Murdoch, was that meeting prior to Brooks and Coulson or after?
After. And but then remember when Murdoch appeared before the select committee in whenever it was 2012 or 13 or whatever, with James.
Yeah.
He only had one ring on. All the other rings had been taken off because they knew that this is a problem. And James keeps on holding his hand to stop him doing it.
What a great thing to kind of have noticed. So when you're sat
That's what my diary's full of.
Well, this is amazing. So when you're sat next to him, this is a meticulous guy. This is a guy who would have known, he might not have previous knowledge of every MP on that committee that was coming with Gerald, but certainly in the run-up to that, he will have been briefed. He'll have made it his business. And I'm sure he'll have probably watched the Coulson Brooks Select Committee in full at the time anyway.
Yeah.
Did he acknowledge you? Was he friendly? Did he mention that exchange at all?
No, and I can't really remember. I mean, it was all quite sort of eggshelly is my memory. But I for years and years and years, I remember on one occasion, Sky used to sponsor a house at Hay, at the Hay Festival. And I'd been invited by the Sky person. And then she had to ring me and say, Rupert said you can't come. And then there were loads of events where if I turned up, I knew I would be told, no, you can't come in, including at party conference and things like that. So sometimes I used to go just to make the point that I wasn't allowed in, you know.
Did you ever manage to blag your way in?
Yes. With Matthew Paris.
Excellent.
And we got in there and Rebecca Brooks said to me, oh, Mr. Bryant, it's dark. Shouldn't you be out cruising somewhere on the heath? And I was just a little bit taken aback. I didn't know what to say. But her then husband, Ross Kemp, said, shut up, you homophobic cow.
Oh, my God.
We're going to run out of stories soon.
I don't think we are. I think we're going to run out of time, but I don't think we're going to run out of stories. I feel like when these, or even before, I mean, if you're happy to just come on every month and just do this kind of greatest hits of some of these incredible... I wanted to ask you about the Russians and the all-party parliamentary group and what went on there. That they had... They effectively got rid of
it. They decided that... Well, the Russian ambassador was very angry that I was the chair of the group partly because I'm gay and more importantly because I was a Putin critic. But the point he always used to make to lots of Tory MPs was it was because I was gay that it was an outrage, it was an insult to Mother Russia and all this. And so he set up a group of conservative friends of Russia and at the embassy, at which they decided to have me removed as chair of the all-party group for Russia. And normally at an all-party group meeting, annual meeting, you have like two members of the House of Lords, one member of the House of Commons and five dogs. On this occasion, we had more than 250 MPs turn up because half the cabinet, including Cameron and Osborne and all sorts of others, turned up to vote me out.
That's incredible, because if people don't, this isn't a select committee. This is all party parliamentary group, as you say, which are usually poorly attended. They're kind of hobby horses. They're often.
It was committee room 18 as well, which is like right up in the eave. So you can't fit more than 20 people in.
So why is Cameron getting involved?
I think it was Michael Howard's idea, or a guy in his office anyway.
There's obviously been suggestions that the Russians have stuff on Donald Trump, but at the time there were suggestions that the Russians had stuff on Boris Johnson, Liam Fox, Alan Duncan, David Davis.
And me, no doubt. You know, I mean, various different organisations who run analytical stuff have sort of checked my social media for trolls and so on, and a lot of it stems straight from St. Petersburg.
It's a remarkable... I mean, any politician who's been in the House of Commons since 2001 will have amassed enough stories and experiences and will have seen stuff. It does feel like you've had a particularly, frankly, astonishing experience since becoming a Member of Parliament.
My husband says, can we stop notching up enemies now?
But the thing is with you is you seem to forgive them in kind of 20-year cycles. So they're enemies for now, but perhaps in 2040, they'll be coming to garden parties.
Well, there's enemies and there's enemies. I mean, I passionately dislike everything that Rupert Murdoch stands for. I loathe what Putin has done to Russia. So, I mean, that's one thing. Having a spat with somebody is another. I can have a spat with a Tory MP in the chamber and be perfectly civil afterwards. You know, it's one of the things you have to decide all the time is if you are trying to achieve something, especially when you're in opposition, how hard do you go in? Is it better to make a fuss so that they really take notice and they're frightened of you? Or is it better just to be a bit more emollient and, you know, get there by collaboration? Difficult balancing act.
Well, it is. And often in the heat of the moment, it's easy prior or post to think about it in that rational way. Sometimes in the heat of the moment, the decision-making ability isn't as sharp as it is with a bit of perspective.
Well, and one of the things I hope I've got right in the book is, I think some of the way I've told some of the events in the book, of course, are events that have been written about before. But because I've got new perspectives and new handwritten accounts from then, I think I'm able to tell it in a different way. And also because I'm an MP, I know that if you're in the Chamber of the House of Commons, the atmosphere can turn on a sixpence. And, you know, you can find yourself suddenly high and dry because you're still speaking in the moment 2 minutes ago and it's all moved on. That's kind of the worst experience of all. It's different this year because so few people are landed in the chamber, but it's a very striking feature of it.
What, the sense that you've misjudged the mood?
Well, I mean, I've seen horrible moments when ministers have completely lost control of the chamber, or played it completely wrong. They've said that they had a good argument and suddenly they've lost the chamber just because of a single sentence and things like that. So most speeches aren't actually read out. They are impromptu or to some degree at least.
Yeah.
It's very different from most other chambers, I think. Most other political, you know, in the Senate, they just read out speeches at each other.
But that's what makes Parliament so watchable, so compelling. And the reason why, by the way, and I've mentioned this earlier, this isn't the first book of yours that I've possessed. Your biographies of Parliament, Parliament the Biography, was volume 1 and 2, is I love Parliament as a place. And just if I have a day off, and people, even politicians think I'm sad when I tell them this, I'll just go and sit on the public gallery and just watch a debate. And I'll have no idea. And it could be anything, couldn't it? It could be about whether to launch military action, or it could be about some really obscure thing about what's happening in a particular local authority somewhere in England. But it is phenomenal watching how it moves, how it exists. And invariably, I come away feeling slightly recharged about politics, because most people on the whole are magnanimous with each other, and people you agree with and disagree with will say things you see politicians that you often see on telly and think, how could I ever agree with anything they say? And they make a really good diplomatic point, which is barely ever shown. But that love of the place, I mean, you must feel a love of Parliament as a, not just the House of Commons as an arena, but I get the sense, I mean, the fact you've written two biographies about it, you must feel an affinity for the magic of the place.
Yeah, I'm not actually a big fan of the chamber itself. It is difficult to project in for most voices, and the lighting is really poor. And when sitting like that
earlier, what, I mean, the lighting—the only thing that strikes me when I'm there is that it's very bright.
It's not. It's really dark.
Oh, really? It feels, maybe when you're on the public gallery or at the kind of light level, it feels kind of overly lit, but it's too dark.
It feels dark, yeah. And the wood adds to it and stuff. It's quite often very difficult to hear anything. Mm. The acoustic is pretty poor in there. And often you're sitting sideways on, which you end up with a really bad back by the end of the day. So I'm not a big fan of the chamber itself. However, you know, it is the cockpit of British democracy, and I love all of that. My favourite bit by a long chalk is Westminster Hall, which is, of course, the oldest bit. And my second favourite bit is the cloisters, which nobody ever gets to see. Yeah. And have been virtually ruined by 20th century meddling with them, but are going to be, I hope, are going to be done up. I'd like to see them more publicly accessible as well.
And are they the ones where you've got the Conservative Research Department and the PLP?
Used to. They moved out through 2 years ago so as to get the work done, but nothing's happened since.
The party, the PLP side of it, which is where Charles I signed Cromwell's death warrant,
debatable.
Well, come on. The story's good. The story's good. Does your research tell you otherwise?
I've yet to find any evidence that that's where it happens. I think it was not that Cromwell's office. It was Thomas Cromwell's office.
Oh, right. Henry VIII.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because it was built under Henry VII.
Oh, but when I was a member of party staff, whenever we went into the PLP bit, people were like, oh, that's where Cromwell's death warrant was signed.
Yeah, I know. But I'm not so sure. It might be true.
Oh, what? But people there.
But, well, as you know from my history of Parliament, there are lots of things which are myths and are untrue about Parliament. It's not two swords lengths apart and all of that.
Yes, that's very true. But again, this is kind of like saying Santa isn't real, isn't it? Like these are.
It really isn't. It really isn't.
It is for me.
It's not even like saying Trump has won.
Chris, I've kept you for far longer than I promised I would. So thank you so much. It would be great to get you back on. When the diaries are out, the glamour boys. People now are going to be so tantalised by wanting to have a peek at your diaries. Do you have any idea when you think you might potentially publish them?
When nobody can find me. Probably.
Okay.
Not for a while. I can't see, I can't see them being published before I have at least announced that I'm leaving Parliament.
Well, that may be a very long time, given that you represent the safe seat. Chris, thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
No, thanks, Matt.
Oh, my God. I felt like I'd stepped out of the cinema after I'd finished speaking to Chris. And there's so many more things where you go, I want to ask you more about this, that and the other, which I know I always say with every guest. And it is always true, so I probably need to stop saying it. But oh my word, what a life. And I think, I don't think we even got 1% of what Chris has seen and experienced and done. And I would love to read those diaries of his. And you think, I'll just publish them now. We've all got to wait God knows how long, 10, 15, 20 years to read them. But I love that the first entry in it is, I'm feeling depressed, or I feel depressed tonight. What a great way for a new MP to start a diary. But my word, what an interview that was. What a guy. And you can buy the book now, The Glamour Boys. I'll put a link in the blurb to the where you can buy the book from Bloomsbury. And of course, other political books are available, including Politically Homeless. And just thank you for all your messages about it. People still getting in touch who thankfully have really enjoyed it, which is very kind of them. And you can email the show, don't forget, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Have a great weekend. I'll see you next week. Ta-ra.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.